and designing something in terms of a financial plan or some kind of program for a household is oftentimes hard to do when you're the one who's in it, because you have blind spots in your own world that you can't see.
Ivan Alon's experiences in the financial industry began at a very young age and have continued throughout his entire career. After beginning his career in investment banking in 1996, Ivan has positioned himself as one of the elite experts in the field of investment banking, but also in the financial services industry. The best-selling author joins us this week to talk about what people can do to improve their situation, how he got started in investing at the ripe young age of 12, and much, much more. Making Your Money Work is a podcast focused on financial education and those who are passionate about it. Whether working on the front lines in a college or in different industries like real estate and investment, we bring you stories, tips, and much more from people who are passionate about helping you live your best life. On this episode of Making Your Money Work, we're joined with a very special guest, a very esteemed guest in the financial services industry, the author of Success as a Financial Advisor for Dummies, among many, many other titles. We won't go into them because I'm sure we could stay here forever. Ivan Alon, really appreciate you giving us some time to chat this afternoon. We're going to dive right into it. Let's start with your background, because I know things in the financial world started for you at a very young age. So let's start with kind of talking about your background and hearing that.
Yeah, definitely. My grandfather was the Undersecretary of the Treasury of Cuba for the Castro Revolutionary Government. So imagine that. He was probably early 30s at the time. This is 1959 when the revolution happened in Cuba. And so it was a very young cabinet. So he was one of the first cabinet members that Castro put together. And he was an economist. And so I heard all about monetary policy, economic policies of a nation from a very young age at the dinner table. I just thought everybody talked about monetary policy at the dinner table. And come to find out, it's definitely not something that's on the forefront of people's minds. And but it was drama. I mean, he talked about Che Guevara putting a gun to his head and demanding he sign economic policy that he just didn't agree with. But he would always tell me, Ivancito, he had a gun. I only had a pen. And I thought, man, that must be important stuff. You know, if you were willing to die, your grandpa's willing to die for economic policy. What the hell is that? And I got to study that. So I had an incredible mentor in him. By the time I was 9 years old, I was reading the journal every day and very interested in the capital markets, because that was also something he never did. He was never an investor, never bought a stock. I think he bought one stock once. He bought like Disney and held it for like a month, and he was like petrified, and he sold it a month later at a small profit. And so he was not that, he never took his economic thinking or his perspective and looked to monetize it or capitalize on it. And I think that's, our relationship was always based on me kind of looking to figure out how to do that. And it was wonderful, because after I wrote my first book, I dedicated it to him and got to present it to him. And he died about a year after that, but he was 92 years old. So he had a very long, full life, and it was wonderful to have a full circle moment with him. And then later on, I ended up going to, so I started day trading by 13. And I had a beeper. This is when pagers were in the this was like 1988, 89. And I had a pager with my broker. And so I'd get beeped, and I would like leave my high school class and like go to the payphone in the hall and make a trade. And then all the teachers knew like what my, like this hobby was. But I was day trading my college fund. And because I asked my dad for it, I said, you're just an electrical engineer. What do you know about this stuff? I've been studying it for years. So give me all my money. And if I lose it, all right, I go to community college. If I do well, I go anywhere I want. I did well. I went to Boston College, got a couple of degrees, and ended up starting in investment banking in Chicago, and in the municipal bond underwriting business, and opened a mutual fund business. So it's kind of an amaze. I mean, it's like one of those stories that unless, you know, it's like so unique and just happens to be, you know, filled with international geopolitical drama.
You said you started trading at 12 and 13 and you had a broker. What was that conversation like talking to a broker as a 13-year-old kid trying to convince them that you were serious and you actually had done your research?
It was crazy. I mean, my voice dropped when I was 12 years old, so that was not an issue. So I sounded very mature, and it was a joint account with my father. And so you know, they saw the birth date, they knew the age, but I had authority. And I don't know, you know, back in the day, in the 80s, I guess the things were a little different. You know, things were a lot more relaxed. And it was a discount broker where I think every trade I made cost, it was like $35. And that was like a really cheap rate on a trade. And of course, now you do trades for free. But I actually day traded mutual funds, which was something that now you can't even do in the industry anymore. And I developed really interesting little techniques that I thought would give me some kind of advantage and making a profit. And I came to learn later in college and formal education that I was actually doing quite a bit of technical analysis. And, you know, I would print out different data sets and hold up the two pieces of paper up to the light. And so I could see, because this is like before Excel, this is like Lotus 1-2-3. And so it was very hard to get multiple data sets on a single page. So I would print them on different pages and get them to line up. And so I obviously had no friends as a kid, and the friends I did have, they were all super geeks as well. So, you know, it was pretty good.
So you mentioned out of school, you went into investment banking, and then you shifted into working with individual investors. What was your path and what led in that decision to kind of make that shift a little bit?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to be in the investment banking world because this was, you know, I was a kid of the 80s. So it was all about American Express Gold Card, a BMW, and drinking Perrier water. So like this was the, you know, this is the Wall Street movie. This is, you know, so I already was in that mindset from a kid and my grandfather. So I always knew I was going to be in the business. And so investment banking just seemed like where I had to start. And in fact, that was a very good place to start because you see how the entire Wall Street machine works. From product development, marketing, you know, lipstick on a pig type products that just get sold to because of the hype is very big in a particular sector or part of the market. So there's just a lot of money that's made in the underwriting of it, of securities, whether it's a bond, whether it's a stock. Tremendous amounts of fees are generated through that activity, and so you really learn from the inside how the entire machine works. And that it really isn't about making great investments for people. It's about making a lot of money off of people. And so that was, and I don't mean to disparage the investment banking industry. It's an incredible part of how our capitalist system works and a very, very valuable part of how it works. But it's a highly profitable machine that is all about maximizing profit on selling stuff. So sometimes you're going to be selling something that you know isn't very valuable, but you're still going to be moving it anyway. So after I started my career, about 4 years, I worked at a big corporation. And then I left and I started my own investment banking consultancy, where I was working with smaller investment management companies who were looking for distribution and doing product development. And so it's kind of like a hired gun for these other companies. And I had some really great, amazing experiences, and I had some very disheartening experiences. And I think that goes with any kind of entrepreneurial experience. And after about a decade of doing that work, I decided, you know, I'm seeing all these financial advisors not really giving advice, just more or less selling product. And they don't really have any intellectual capital of their own that they're really showcasing. So I'd like to start my own retail advisory shop and just have what I consider to be a more reasonable and true value add solutions for people based on my own intellectual capital, my own experience, what I have seen in my background. And I started that 15 years ago, and the practice has certainly grown beautifully, and I have a wonderful network of advisors around the country that leverage the intellectual capital that I've built through various portfolios that we manage. And so I think it's always so important that, especially if you have an entrepreneurial spirit in you and you have a vision of how you want your life to be and how you want to be showing up day to day in your life, that you have to do it. And for me, this was a compulsion. It was my passion. So I really didn't care if I had failure after failure after failure. It didn't bother me. I never was bothered by it because, you know, this is, we get one life and you got to make the most of it. And I think what I've learned from other entrepreneurs over the years is it's like breathing. There's no option. And so, you know, for me to work in a corporate job, somebody telling me what to do every day or what reports I need to have submitted by a certain time, I'd rather go be a farmer in Iowa and you know, grow some special leaves and sell them. And, you know, I would do something very, very different with my life if I couldn't express myself in a entrepreneurial way.
Now, from that, I'm guessing from your experiences grew the realization that there was a need for the book like Success as a Financial Advisor for Dummies. So what was there one thing that kind of one light bulb moment where you realized this is something that's really needed, or what led to you writing that?
So my first book was more of a passion project, and which was called How to Hire or Fire Your Financial Advisor, 10 Simple Questions to Guide Decision Making. And I wrote that because at the time there was a lot of confusion, I think, about what a financial advisor really is, how to really ferret out whether you're working with a good one, or how to really identify, like, what's the difference? Everybody calls themselves a financial advisor, you know, so it's like, well, what is the difference? You know, do some people have certain licenses, other people don't, can't do certain things, but this moniker has really been abused, and it's used in a very generalized way. I think the SEC now is trying to clarify that. I think there's at least this attempt to clarify it, but the marketplace is still very, very confused. The consumer is still very, very confused, and rightfully so. And the industry really hasn't done anything to help that. So the first book was really about, you know, kind of telling a little bit about my own personal story, but then really weighing in. It's not a long book, 100 pages, less than 100 pages, and it just talks about how to really identify a financial advisor that is worth working. There's a little checklist of 10 questions you should ask of an advisor. So I wrote that. And then about 3 years later, Wiley, the publisher of the Four Dummies books, called me and said, hey, we read your first book. We'd be interested in you writing a book for us. And they wanted to write on international investing. And I thought, well, it's a good big topic, very needy, lots of interesting things there. But how about this idea? Let me write a sequel to the first book, but the sequel will be about how to really be an advisor that doesn't get fired, how to be a great advisor. And so it had to go to committee and blah, blah, blah. And long and short of it is they thought it was a great idea. And so I wrote that really as a textbook and a manual for everything, certainly that I've done in my own world and my own practice, and also as a distillation of everything I've learned from all the different aspects of working in the financial services industry, from the investment banking side and all of the variety of things I've seen. And also trying to create a standard of what exactly it means to be successful, and also what it means to be a financial advisor. And there are core competencies, there are subject matters, there are activities that a financial advisor should be engaging in with every client. And by and large, they certainly are not inclusive of all these core competencies. Most people focus on one aspect or another, like investments or insurances. And I have a core belief that if you're going to be a financial advisor, you really have to accept the reality that good advice is based on asset and liability management simultaneously. These are two halves of the same coin. If you focus too much on investments and then something blindsides or unexplained or when something happens in your life that now you've got to deplete your investments, well, that's a terrible plan. You know, that's a terrible financial program. And so you really have to assess risks in your household, in your world, personally, and in your job. And otherwise, it's just not really a financial understanding at all. Now, so what's interesting is CFOs at companies do this every single day. They are managing the assets and resources of a company, and they are managing the liabilities and risks of a company. Every single day, that's what a CFO does. For some reason, the popular, you know, as a society, we haven't taken that exact structure and put it to the household level, which is everybody really needs to be looking out at their asset accumulation and that growth, but also the risk management. And these are things that have to be dealt with simultaneously. And instead, they're really bifurcated or trifurcated often in practice.
From your experiences dealing with people, why do you think that is, that that's something that people just kind of push to the back burner or don't even want to deal with?
Well, ultimately, I think it's that because of how the financial services industry has been serving the consumer for so many years, from really its inception, or I shouldn't say the inception, I wasn't around 100 years ago or whatever, but you know, certainly the past 30, 40 years, it has been a product delivery mechanism. So you, when you would meet with somebody who's a financial professional, they have an agenda of what needs to be sold, either that day or that month or that year or whatever. But, you know, people in our society in the United States have come to know that basically you meet with a financial person, they're going to sell you something. This is the popular understanding of it. And so as a result, consumers just end up collecting different people and products as the years go on. And they don't have anything that's really cohesive, or maybe they own stuff that isn't even appropriate for them anymore, because there has really been no advisor that's held their hand and stewarded good decision-making over the years. And the industry hasn't been set up that way. The industry has been set up as, hey, sell something, make some commissions. So it is, in fact, something that is under big change right now, not only from Congress and legislation, but also individual states like New York, like Regulation 187, which is addressing these conflicts of interest and these challenges that the consumer has in identifying what's really in their best interest and how do they figure out if somebody is recommending something in their best interest.
We're going to stay with kind of the theme of the consumer here. From whether it's things that you feel the industry hasn't done a good job of, you know, providing the information to the consumer about, or things that are just misunderstood, what are some of the biggest issues that you see people grappling with or not understanding and maybe making a wrong decision because they don't have that knowledge?
Yeah. So certainly there's different tiers because, you know, certainly most consumers have 401k plans, for example. And there's really simple things, like I said earlier, you know, somebody is at the peak of their earnings, you know, they're in their 50s. They could be maxing out that 401k, getting that maximum match if the company offers one. And that's such a simple thing that somebody can do to maximize the accumulated growth and savings that they would have at retirement. You know, how does somebody even get that advice? There's no money to be made by a financial advisor in giving somebody that advice. So what we have seen in our industry is more of an evolution towards fee-based planning, and even ongoing subscription service model planning. And that is a very powerful way to serve people with advice where you are getting compensated for that good guidance looking out for the best interest of your client. And not just giving away that advice for free, but actually adding value. So that is actually an area of the financial services industry that I think is going to continue to grow. It's already begun a very steep growth, but it's something that I think more, especially professionals who are in this business, are going to have more access to platforms and programming that will allow them to serve clients in that way. And that's a game changer, because now you're going to be able to hire somebody who actually has to know something, who actually has to give you advice. And the products may or may not be in the mix, but the products and how an advisor gets paid is also under evolution. You know, a lot of products are now either without any kind of comp or any kind of fee or commission, because it is formatted for a fee-based advisor who charges a flat fee or what have you to do that kind of work. So the industry, from a product development standpoint, is actually evolving to serve the consumer in this, what I think is certainly a much more progressive way to align the interest between advisor and consumer.
Do you think that's something that has kind of evolved and developed because of the growing ability for information to be out there and for people to kind of just search on their own, educate themselves, and find the info?
Absolutely. I mean, we Google everything. I mean, we Google our health, we Google, you know, and it's horrible, the returns you see that, you know, it's, oh my God, I'm going to die. You know, it's like, so of course you still have to go to the doctor, you know, so you Google, but you still want to see an expert. You still want to get that kind of perspective before you really make a commitment or a decision to something. So I think the technology has given a lot more information. Information is highly commoditized. You don't even know really what's real or not real. But regardless, it is a good framework to start to process how something may be relevant for you or not. And that gives you more education so that when you do interact with an advisor, now it's about them educating you. And an advisor who's educating you and giving you that perspective, that's exactly what we want in our profession and in our community. And anything that looks or resembles more like just, you know, square peg, square hole solution and forcing people into a particular product is something I think the regulators not only are on top of, but have their sights squarely on this point. And I think in the next, I'd say within 5 years, we'll live in an environment that's much more void of commissions and conflict of interest type compensation, and much more about the value that's being added from actual advisors with real experience and real expertise or real training. And even some of the certification programs like the CFP board, they have done, you know, really fantastic work in refining what it means to be a financial advisor, to be a certified financial planner, and some of the conflicts that exist between the company that CFP may work at and what the CFP board wants in terms of their behavior. So these kinds of things are all at play right now. And all of that, I think, is for the benefit of the consumer ultimately, because if nothing else, the consumer needs more support and needs more advice because they have so much more information coming at them, and everybody's got the hot idea and the great tip and all of these things. And so you really need more professionals in the marketplace that can be good, solid resources.
On the investment side, is there one, whether it's, you know, stocks, mutual funds, 401k, one thing that you see people coming in thinking, okay, I've done my research, I know what I need to know, but they're extremely mistaken, or they just haven't, they're missing a big piece of the information?
Yeah. I think people just like, I really like using the healthcare industry as a good proxy for this discussion, because when people go visit their doctor or the surgeon, you know, something's been diagnosed, you're going to have a procedure. When people go to the surgeon, they don't say, well, I'd really like to know what scalpel you're going to use on me. And could I see it? Can I examine it? I'd like to know everything about that scalpel. Well, it's actually something that nobody ever asks about. What people want to know when they go see the surgeon is they want to know the experience, the technique, the skill, just, you know, how capable, how competent that person is. You know, did they drink too much coffee that morning? Maybe you care about, or, you know, not enough coffee. But, you know, you want to know about the person. You want to know about the professional. In the financial services industry, it's not that way at all. Everyone walks in only wanting to know about the tool, to know about the implement. The advisor, the value of the advisor is highly discounted, almost to nothing. And because the assumption is that they're just there selling tools and implements, like a door-to-door, you know, salesman, like, you know, the way they used to sell vacuum cleaners back in the day, throwing door, you know, put the foot in the door and throw dirt on the carpet. And then, oh, now you got to vacuum it up. I mean, that was the technique that vacuum salespeople used. And society, you know, kind of got to a point where they didn't accept that anymore. And so, you know, I think that's where we have to support the consumer and help highlight the fact that, no, this is not at all about tool selection. This is about the design. And designing something in terms of a financial plan or some kind of program for a household is oftentimes hard to do when you're the one who's in it, because you have blind spots in your own world that you can't see, that a good professional will be able to identify. We see this all the time, for example, in closely held family businesses, where, you know, by far that closely held family business is the most valuable asset in their whole world. And yet they've done very little planning to protect the household if something or someone in that business goes wrong or has some challenge. So that I think is one of the great examples of how the financial services industry has really failed to show up and serve communities in a more holistic way, because of closely held family business doesn't necessarily have a lot of liquidity, you know, so there's no money to manage there. So nobody is lining up to talk to those people. But there's a lot of other things that can be done, especially if you're paid on a subscription fee or fee-based model. Like, now you can serve these families and businesses in a really productive, helpful way.
We'll wrap it up with one more question here. I know you're a busy guy. If one of our listeners or someone is looking to kind of start investing, start trying to set that financial plan for the future for themselves and them, their family, what's one piece of advice that you would just give to someone who's looking to do that?
I think that there are very good resources out there and big firms that focus on the do-it-yourself investor. And I don't need to name those firms. They advertise all the time, and they have online resources that walk you through a process and an education step-by-step, give you information. And then they even have people that you can call if you want more information. So there really is more of a catering to the do-it-yourself type of person who's just looking to get some initial guidance. The other thing is, I always think education, self-education, is always very valuable. And so there are very good books out there. I've got a book out there that talks about all these core competencies that a financial advisor should have, but certainly a retail investor, a retail household, can benefit from all the exact same content. That, you know, just maybe specialized for how to do it professionally. And then there's other resources available for similar support. But that's one thing I think that, if anything, you can be inundated. The other thing that's overlooked and very quickly is your other friends, family. You know, people are in your network are already working maybe with somebody and have had a good experience and are happy to share the name of that person. And so you can have a conversation with that person. I think that's also a great thing to bring up at your next family gathering or, you know, when you're at the bar and, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, you're working with anybody, any financial advisor or anything like, you know, you'd be surprised how many young people there are that are in this business that are looking to add value and have certainly their clients' best interests at heart.
Ivan Alon, thanks so much. If people want to connect with you or find you or get the book, where can they do that?
They can go to my website, which is ivanalon.com, ivanillan.com, and you can contact me through there. And there's links to articles and the books and all of those good things.
Great. Ivan, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome, Isaac. Thank you.
Now, if you enjoyed this episode as much as I did, make sure to click that subscribe button and leave a rating and let us know how we're doing, what we can do to help you, and what topics you want to hear. Additionally, if there's someone you think would be a great interview for the podcast, make sure to follow us on social media and let us know. We at Squire are here to help you, so don't be afraid to reach out no matter what question or issue you're running into. We look forward to hearing from you and talking to you on social media.